Welcome to the Alex Tremble Show, where we share the strategies and secrets you need to know in order to successfully increase your influence, build strategic networks, and advance in your career. An award-winning speaker, author, and leadership coach, Alex brings executive leaders from across the world to share their inspirational stories and insights to help you become an exceptional public servant while also reaching your career goals. Without further ado, here's your host, Alex D. Tremble.
Hello, everyone. This is Alex Tremble from the Alex Tremble Show, and I am so happy to be here with you. I feel so blessed. Thank you for joining me and us today. Today, we have with us Michael Mulroy. Michael is the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East, a retired paramilitary operations officer within the CIA, and a retired U.S. Marine. He is also a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute, an analyst for ABC News, and the co-founder of In Child Soldiering and the co-founder of LeBeau Institute. Michael, or Mick as we'll call him today, and I will be talking about a number of topics ranging from the events leading up to the January 6, 2001 insurrection attack, assault on the U.S. Capitol, how that came to be and what his recommendations are for us to be rooting that extremist, those extremist views out of our military and out of our ranks. We'll also be talking about child soldiering and what's going on around the world in that regard and how we can stop that. And really the leadership that you and I and all of us can play as we end corrupt and it's horrible, horrible deeds like that, whether it be here in the United States or around the world. And finally, we're going to have a great, interesting conversation about a leader's role when it comes to mentoring and how you should be mentoring and how you should be feeding in and pouring into those around you. So I'm going to invite you ahead of time. If you enjoyed this conversation, found that you want to engage and continue to engage in conversation, please feel free to join me at thealextremble.com. That's where my podcast blog site is. And ask any questions, chime in on any articles that are up there, and start a conversation with me. I'd love to hear from you. Without any further ado, here goes the show. Hello, everyone. This is Alex Tremble from the Alex Tremble Show. And again, today we have another treat to be able to talk to a man who has not only led through our U.S. armed forces, but has led through a number of leadership positions within the government, which touches a very important topic that we will definitely be hitting on, but I'll give you a hint, something to do with January 6, 2021. If you hit me, I did what that is, you kind of have an idea where we're going. So I would like to just say, how are you doing today, Mick? How is your day going out there in Montana?
Well, first, Alex, thanks for having me on your show. Every day is a good day in Montana. And actually last night, as we were talking about before the show started, we had about 6 inches of snow. And since I live in the town of Whitefish, which has a ski resort, it's a positive thing. Not so much for the people in Washington, D.C. necessarily, but out here in Montana, we kind of rejoice when the snow starts coming down.
Well, again, we were talking before we started, out here in the Woodbridge, Virginia area where I am, Washington, D.C. area, the weather has been unseasonably warm, and that is not a good thing. For ecology wise, anyways, people may think sure. It's fun, but you know.
Right. Yeah. We have a little bit of that too here in Montana, a little bit of warm. Today's a different story, but we've been in the 40s several times last week, which for the people who grew up here, not me, is really odd.
Well, you know, I wanted to thank you for taking the time to jump on and talk with us today. You were actually the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense for the Middle East, retired paramilitary operations officer for the CIA, retired Marine, retired boxing instructor. Is that a still thing?
Yes, it's a family thing, right? My uncle used to call it the Irish martial art, right? Boxing. Yeah, no, I was never a great boxer. I was I boxed in the Marine Corps a bit, and I coached in the Marine Corps as a hobby, if you will. But no, I love it.
Well, you've done some fantastic things that you're quote unquote retired, and I'm doing some air quotes right now because you're doing a lot of stuff still as you're quote unquote retired. I was hoping that we could talk about January 6, 2021. For those who are not familiar, there was an insurrection there was a storming of the U.S. Capitol, and I thought it would be a fantastic time to reach out and talk to someone who actually has experience in researching and talking about these issues to kind of maybe shed some light on how this came to be. Do you have any initial thoughts you want to start the conversation off with?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, I mean, most of my career as a paramilitary officer in the CIA, and I understand a lot of people wouldn't know what that is, but it's kind of the special operations component of the agency. It takes from U.S. military special operations, so SEALs, Green Berets, Marines, and then we do the type of operations that the CIA gets directed to by the president. So as you might guess, a lot of that involves conflicts and conflict in areas around the world, irregular warfare, our version of it, and counterinsurgency. So I've spent most of my career in those areas. So when we, after I retired from the not only the CIA, but for working for the Department of Defense, I started working as an analyst for ABC News, among other things. And they asked me, I think back in early November or October, to take a look at the U.S. as I would looking at another country when it comes to a potential insurgency, and whether we were in what the CIA called the incipient insurgency stage, which just like it sounds means like before one happened. So it wasn't my area of expertise. I didn't focus on anything domestic. But of course, I looked at it from my experience. And we put out a paper, I think November, mid-November, that really looked at whether we would have an insurgency. The paper didn't really answer the question, left that as a question mark. But I really started looking at a lot of the groups, both on the far left and the far right, what they were doing, what the FBI considered the threats coming from their were, and what they might do in the future. And then, once the events of January 6th happened, and all of a sudden we started hearing names like Boogaloo Boys and Oath Keepers and all these names that most people, most Americans would not be familiar with. Those were all the groups, at least on the far right, that I looked at in the paper. So it, people started changing the question mark behind my will there be an American insurgency to an exclamation point. I mean, right? It was unfortunate, right? Certainly unfortunate. It was a terrible event. But, then I'm certainly not an expert. There's probably far more people that have looked at domestic terrorism, but because of my experience looking at terrorism worldwide in this research project I got involved on, we started looking at it much more. And now we're looking at how to root it out of the military, for example. But there's a lot of things that have flown from this initial research.
Well, let's if we can take it one step back and say, actually, would you mind defining an insurrection? I've had the question already posed to me. If those who are paying attention to world events right now, it is February 5th, 2021, and there was a military coup in Myanmar. So maybe can you? Is there a difference between a coup and an insurrection?
So a coup generally comes from within the government. So if you have, like, for example, if in the, let's just use Myanmar. So you have a military component that takes over the government from the elected civilians. That would be a coup d'etat because it's internal. An insurgency is a group of people who are willing to use force basically to enforce their political objectives, which in a case of an insurgency would be to replace the government with an entirely new government. There's a lot of different definitions when it comes to which stage it's in, but generally speaking, it is the use of military or paramilitary force against the government to either fundamentally change the government or to replace the government.
So then to go continue down that line of thinking, you mentioned DOD wanting to look into this and making sure that they're rooting those, maybe those factions out of their workforce. That's not going to be easy, I assume. I think it's a very difficult process. I'll say right now, I saw a newspaper, or not newspaper, I saw an article online talking about how I think a Congress member wants, I think maybe it was like everyone serving at DOD or military or something like that, to have their social media checked before they're being able to join. Like, this could be a very intrusive process. How would you recommend that DOD, but really any organization, any leadership, go about identifying those types of individuals who could be dangerous and definitely would not be supportive of diversity, inclusion, so on and so forth, and root them out? How would you recommend this?
Yeah, those are all good questions, Alex. To start with the first component, you know, yes, it'll be difficult, but it's necessary to put it in really plain terms. The research shows that there are groups on both. So the last number that I saw, there's like 380 armed groups on the far right in the United States whose intent is either to prepare for a civil war or to confront the government with force. And now there is a growing group movement on the left. I think there's around 50 in the last research statistic. Groups on the far left that are now arming themselves. Most of them say because the far right is arms of the far left, you know. But either way, you end up with a lot of armed groups, okay? Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. We have groups that think something is going to happen, and I think they're actually trying to create the actual situation that they claim to be worried about. The most lethal component of it is people that are trained already. And the U.S. military is the most effective military force. I'm biased, of course. You know, I served an enlisted Marine, an officer in the Marine Corps, and then obviously the CIA we already talked about. And then as a civilian, we have the most effective training in the world. So when we train somebody, we can make a one person that can have an exponential effect if he joins a group that is, you know, intent on doing violence. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So that's why I say it's necessary. We have to try to eradicate it from our ranks, far left and far right. And I always say that because I think if you really want to have an effect, you can't go at this as just from one side looking at the other. There's issues of extremists on both sides, and you have to go in there and say, like, we're not tolerating any extremists, whether you're far left or far right, you know, we're not having it. You can't not support the Constitution and the government of which you took an oath to defend. So if that's got to be the first thing we do is go into the military, and then people will kind of roll their eyes when you say a commission because then it goes on for a year or something. And it really has to have, it already has the support. We saw Secretary Austin do a 60-day stand down. So we know we have his support. It was a great idea. But once they really take a look at this, there need to be positive steps that they can take to, I mean, we all want it to be eradicated, but we certainly need to start limiting it as soon as possible. To your question on social media, I mean, is it intrusive? So anybody who's gone through at least the initial basic training of the Marine Corps will find out how intrusive they can be. And it's going to be a lot more intrusive than looking at your Facebook page. And of course, in the agency, you know, everything you do is completely looked at. So at least coming from a personal perspective, I would say looking at your social media posts is not something that's too far. I think if you feel the need to post extremist views on your social media, you shouldn't be able to join the military, period. If you're actually posting things that support violence, you probably should be talking to an investigator, you know, so and certainly not talking to a recruiter. So I don't think looking at your social media posts is out of bounds. And I think there has to be more than just that because people, of course, can either go on anonymously or scrub their social media. They're not going to be able to do a deep dive like you would do for somebody that's going in the CIA on every person that joins the military. I mean, it's just exponentially different amount of people that do those. So you're going to have to come up with reasonable measures to determine their affiliation, and you'll have to accept that, you know, you might have a smaller military. I hope that's not the case, because I hope we're talking about actually small numbers of people. But, you know, if we're balancing, you know, we need to keep our recruiting numbers up, and do we want, you know, people with extremist views? I just say, we don't want people with extremist views. Don't worry about your recruiting numbers.
Yeah. You know, I have another question for you, but I love that you brought up the looking at both and all sides to make sure you're rooting out that behavior. I cannot tell you how many people I've spoken to over the last, you know, 4 years who are very willing to excuse the behavior of their side because the other side did something, and vice versa. It's both sides always saying, well, we had to do this because they're doing this, so we have to do this. So I guess how do you broach those conversations to try to convince someone, hey, look, just because someone threw a stone at you doesn't mean to throw a stone back at them. How would a leader approach this? How would you approach this?
You know, so, I mean, part of being in the society is that we all agree on certain rules and we all stick to them, whether it's, you know, criminal laws or civil liabilities. That's part of being a society. And our society, at least the core of it, is the Constitution. So, you know, it functions if everybody agrees that that's our guiding principles. And that is everything from people have the right to free speech, for example, in the First Amendment, but that speech can't advocate harming somebody else, because that takes it out of a protected category of speech and into a crime. Because, you know, as you would want that done to you, right? It's kind of a social pact. Also, we have a system of elections and people get to vote. That's part of our system, which is obviously a democracy, a representative democracy, and people have to then accept the fair outcome. And it's not, you know, I will only accept the constitutional process of elections if it suits my preferred outcome. It can't be that. So, I mean, as a leader, I would, if I was in the Pentagon, and I'm sure, you know, my friends that are still there are going to be doing this, is we're going to look at this objectively. We're not going to pick sides. Like, to your point, you can't advocate for the extremists on your side and just point on their side. In fact, I have friends on the right and left, many. You know, what I tell them when they ask is, if you, whatever side you're on, you would be better served by focusing on the extremism on your side. You're going to have more of an influence on tamping down the extremism on the left or the right, if you're on that side. They just expect for you to attack the other side, right? And at the end of the day, everybody loses if the extremists take, well, it's like an knife fight, right? Everybody loses. You're getting cut. Everybody's getting cut. You know, that it is just, people need to, if anything, the 6th of January assault should be a wake-up call. And not just a wake-up call on the problem of extremism on the right, but just extremism in general. We don't want a situation where we are pitting our far left or far right groups against one another, because then we're going to have a significant problem.
Well, I want to kind of take this from the macro standpoint, and it doesn't get more macro than the U.S. Department of Defense.
Sure.
You guys are a massive organization. Right. And so if anyone knows about making culture change at that large level, it would need to be, I would say, you or so someone who's been in your role. So how would you recommend that leaders go about trying to change the culture, implementing some new process, like we're talking about, across an agency, again, serving as the former Deputy Assistant Secretary of, again, the largest organization within the federal government, that comes with some challenges, but I would assume some opportunities.
Yeah, that's a really good point. In fact, I might steal it. I haven't even thought about the fact that the Defense Department has throughout history been in many ways the leading on the leading edge of social reform, whether it's integration, on race or on, homosexuality, for example. They did that. Once the DOD gets on board and figures out how to make it work, I think a lot of society then is more inclined to fall in. Right. Mm-hmm. I think that's a very positive thing. The DOD, it's not what the DOD is for, but I think you can look at in history how significant, in the 50s and the 60s and the 90s of really pushing forward social reform in a very positive way. This would be in a way, it's different, of course, because we're trying to remove an element in there that is toxic to the rest of society, people who don't believe in, well, essentially all the other things I just discussed, and are willing to use violence to try to get to their stated objectives and go outside of the Constitution, because there's all sorts of safeguards that are in the Constitution. So, but it is leading potentially a social reform in that it's becoming intolerant of intolerance. I know that sounds a little odd to say.
No, but I love it, actually.
Yeah, the Defense Department needs to be that. They need to say that if we end up with a smaller Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marine, it's, again, I don't think it's going to be a significant amount or we got real problems. But if it is, so be it. Do they have a military that represents the values of the American people and the U.S. Constitution?
If I can really quickly just switch gears, you are also the co-founder of End Child Soldiering. Really quickly, so everyone else, what is that organization and what are you guys doing?
Yeah, so the consultant group I work with is called Lobo Institute. It focuses on conflicts because most of the people that are involved, particularly my partner and I, my partner Eric Ulrich is a retired Navy SEAL, served 24 years as a SEAL, and we worked together when I was in the agency all over the world in mostly conflict areas. One thing we saw a lot of was children forced to be fighters, something that I hope every adult would be against, period. We actually became friends with one, close friends, and we did a documentary. It was kind of an amateur documentary. We did it like on our iPhones and GoPros, but it became more than we ever thought it would be. It has been screened many places, many universities and think tanks. And one of the things we saw at the end of it was people say this, it's a very inspirational story about a terrible topic, right? So this is about it's called My Star in the Sky, and it's about a child, a male child and a female child that were both abducted. They fell in love. They ended up escaping, and now they have family together, and they take in children in the Lord's Resistance Army. That was that. So we get to the end, and people say, what can I do? And we'd be like, I don't know, just we made the documentary. And then people say, well, you need to come up with something for us to do. So we started screening it for other NGOs that do address this issue, which is great. And then we decided just essentially because it was easier for us to be able to collectively help these groups. We started our own. We're on the board of directors for many. But the whole point to your question is End Child Soldiering is an NGO that goes to groups that are out in the field doing stuff with kids, usually to rehabilitate them, to convince them they do have a valuable role in society and give them an actual skill that they can have a job other than carrying an AK-47. Mm-hmm. So it's very much a practical group. We find groups that are out there that can't be, in DC raising money. And it's a 100% support that people in the field doing the mission. And that's what End Child Soldiering. So it's related to Lobo Institute, but it's its own entity and it's in the process of getting its nonprofit status.
Again, I love the mission and I'm with you. Anyone who does not agree with that mission, I don't want to say anything negative, but they're not a great person.
Maybe we draw that. Yeah.
Yeah. So what was so interesting to me is that you found a cause, something that you are passionate about, something that you thought needed to be fixed or addressed, and you did it, you and your partner. But this is not a your community thing, right? This is in my backyard. It's not even, this is in my state. This is a global issue. So how did you, I guess, muster the courage to try something, to try to fix something this large? And then what are the first steps that you would take to try to address something this large? And I say this because I talk to people all the time who say they see problems, they see something they want to do. A lot of public service servants see things that they know need to be fixed, but they also feel like I'm too small to address this. Mm-hmm. So how did you go about mustering the courage? And then what were the steps you took to start addressing this challenge?
So I think that's a good series of questions. I think the first thing was the experience I had. And it wasn't unusual for people in my role or people in special operations or military. But you see the use of kids all over the world on the battlefield, especially the longer the war goes on, the younger your opponents seem to get. And then specifically with the Lord's Resistance Army, which for your audience was a insurgency in Uganda against the government there. But it became known because eventually almost all of its soldiers were children. So it was essentially a child army. And then with bipartisan support, it's a very bipartisan issue, and there's not many in Washington, to support ending the Lord's Resistance Army and capturing Joseph Kony, the leader. So the U.S. military got involved. It was started under President Bush. It was doubled down under President Obama. And it was a very effective use of the military to try to end an insurgency through mostly influence operations, not direct operations that would have resulted in a lot of casualties, which obviously would not be good. But it was that very real, all of it, but especially that, which was all kids. And then meeting an individual who now, I mean, his two youngest sons are my godsons, but he was a former child soldier in the Lord's Resistance Army. He's one of the nicest guys you ever meet, but you know, what he went through was hellacious. And it's being written about by a really good author, which is going to really help the cause because he's been gracious enough to donate a portion of the proceeds to End Child Soldiering, right? The other part I would say is, you know, if it's just me and Eric, it probably won't have the impact that we both want. It's going to have to be much more than just one person's NGO. It needs to be a global effort. It is a global problem. I mean, it goes from the Philippines to many places in the Middle East, Africa, all the way over to South America, right? The last paper we did, it estimated up to 100,000 children will be enforced to fight. They were talking like 12-year-olds, and boys and girls. The problem is they essentially do what adults tell them. They're very cheap. They're very replaceable. And because of the advent of weapon systems that are lighter and lighter and lighter, but they're more lethal, you know, a smaller person like a child can carry it. So it's a horrible recipe for what we're seeing. I think the last statistic the UN put on it, it doubled in the Middle East in 2019. And it's most countries will sign up to the protocol that they won't do it, and then they just ignore their own obligations. I would hope that the incoming or the new administration, which I know many of, are going to really enforce the laws. They're both in the United States and the United Nations protocols against not just adversaries, but also allies and partners that may also find it easy to either support a group that uses child soldiers or use them themselves. It's just time that I think, you know, if adults want to start the wars, they ought to fight them.
Thank you for tuning in to the Alex Tremble Show. We'll be right back after a word from our sponsors.
Federal open season is over, but you can apply for WEPA life insurance year-round. WEPA has been insuring the future of federal employees for more than 75 years. WEPA can be used as a supplement or a replacement for FEGLI and can cost less. Last year, members who switched saved $375 on average.
Apply for WEPA Group Term Life Insurance and see how much you could save by visiting WAEPA.org today.
The results are in. Research has found that networking is one of the four skills absolutely required to successfully advance in your career. However, when asked, most government employees state that they don't network because they believe that networking is for extroverts and for people who care more about their own careers than the organization's mission. But what if there was a way to ethically network without looking self-absorbed and being a super extrovert? Well, there is. Alex Tremble has created a 7-week online networking course specifically designed to give ambitious leaders like yourself the skills needed to become a strategic networker. This course uses time-tested and research-backed strategies to help you identify, build, and maintain critical relationships with influential leaders. Visit alextremble.com/courses/networking to learn more about his networking model today. Use the discount code PODCASTFAMILY on the checkout screen to receive a 20% discount. Don't delay. Enroll today at alextremble.com/courses/networking. And now back to the Alex Tremble Show with your host, Alex Tremble.
Well, again, 100% agreement. And I want to ask you a difficult question. I do want to make underscore what I want to make sure everyone heard what Mick said about he used his background to start him off on this route. I think everyone should and feel comfortable doing that. Everyone has experiences. Whether you're a one-year-old baby, you have experiences that you grow up on to grow from that point. Whether you are a 60-year-old person, 70-year-old person, 30-year-old person, we all have experiences. And you use those experiences, those unique experiences, as a foundation to build upon. I talked to someone the other day, you know, if you're an accountant, there's a million different accountants, but what makes you different than that accountant? Well, because you grew up here, you had a different childhood, you had whatever experience you have, bring those to the table and use those to help you reach your goals. So thank you for making that point. And the difficult question I'd like to pose to you, and again, if you can't, let me know, politics, right? It's easy to say you're going to do something, to say you're against something, and then politics comes into play. As a leader, how do you make situations tenable for leaders to make the right answer? Sometimes they want to do it, but they think politically, I can't do this. Like how would you, and you can even use an example if you have one, how would you go about helping the person say yes, making the yes decision easier politically?
Yeah, so I'm not a political person, and Lobo and is not political at all. In fact, we deliberately want to stay out of politics because we want to be able to influence and advise both sides of the spectrum. I think when it comes to this issue, it's odd in the fact that, you know, Democrats and Republicans all agree. If you look at like the Child Soldier Prevention Act, which I think was passed, in, I can get wrong, but 2008, it was like 100%. Like everybody voted for it. Like, how are you not going to vote for it? I mean, you're really going to take a stand and say, no, I think this is a great idea that we have 12 years. Right. So nobody's going to say it. I think the problem we've run into is, what are you going to do to the allies and partners who may benefit the United States in other ways, who do this? And what I would say is, the U.S. in general, so maybe taking it out of politics, you're talking to politicians, of course, take it out of politics is, what do you want to be known for as a country? And if we're willing to be compromising on the use of kids as soldiers, then we aren't what we say we are. We're not representing what we say we are, even at the core. We're not talking about like advanced individual liberties and freedom of speech. We're talking about basically not using children as chattel. So, I mean, that's how I went on this. I mean, you got to do more than just sign the law or be rhetorically in support. You have to be willing to say, and I don't need to point out, I have no problem pointing out, but there's certain countries that just, you know, use other surrogate forces that are using kids. They have to be responsible not only to not do that, but ensure they're not doing it. And if they are, then we need to enforce some kind of a punishment on them. It can't just be rhetorical. It has to be. And the other part of your question, I mean, if you look at this issue, when it comes to being involved, I mean, you don't have to be a person that traveled around the world to get involved in helping a kid that was forced to be a soldier. I mean, they need an occupation. So it could be a mechanic. I mean, that's one of the things that we do. We have mechanics that actually go to countries and help teach them that, or a farmer, or, you know, all sorts of stuff that is within the wheelhouse of plenty of people in the United States to help, or around the world to help. In fact, the last thing my skill set is what they don't need, right? So they don't need a soldier or special operations type person. They already did that. In fact, we want to get them far away. Unfortunately, sometimes the only real job you can find is in a legitimate army once you're an adult. But I mean, that's really not, you don't want that to be the primary thing. You want to find them a career where they can have a family and be part of society and have a vocation. So to the other part of your point, there's lots of things that people get involved in. It's not just like contributing, you know, money, which is nothing wrong with that. But if you want to actually do something, then I would hope that there's groups out there that would look for people who want to volunteer to teach these kids a skill set that they can use in the future.
And thank you for answering the way you did, because it's like sometimes, and got a military helicopter outside. Sometimes when I say the word political, I go to people's head like, oh, politics, Democrats, Republicans. No, it's the influence, you know, campaign. And, you know, I was listening and Cory Booker was talking the other day about how him and his Republican counterpart were at odds on a policy, or he was putting forward something that that the Republicans didn't agree with. And what he did was he remembered that he had met this Republican guy whose daughter was adopted, and this bill was about adoption, and he went and spoke to him, but hey, look, this is important, you know, making that connection. And the Republican guy came over and actually co-sponsored the bill. And what you made me think of is the importance of having those conversations. Like you said, what are we going to be known for? What do you want to be known for? And making that emotional push, in addition to the data, you know, that emotional push is really important, it seems.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, the relationship you build, I don't know anything about politics, but the example that you're saying, I think carries through in all sorts of enterprises, right? Whether it's business, other parts of government, the military, it's the relationships, you know? And if you don't take the time to develop strong relationships, one, you're kind of missing out on fundamentals of life, having friends and colleagues, but you're also probably not gonna get much done, because if you just sit in your own silo and you're all about grandstanding, which is what I would say if you're not actually trying to reach across, you're not gonna get much done. So in a political sense, you're there to represent your constituents. So having that relationship that you can actually talk to somebody and come to some kind of negotiation, whether it's in politics or business or government, or, I mean, I've seen it on the ground in war-torn countries, but I maintain those relationships, and so do all my colleagues. I mean, and they come back, and that's why we get really attached to the partner forces that we fight alongside. But that's not just in my context, it's in everybody. So having these relationships is key, I think, to the functioning of whatever enterprise you're in, but also whether you accomplish anything you want to accomplish. And emotionally, I mean, that stats does matter, maybe even more than emotion. But, you know, people remember the way you made them feel. And quite frankly, if you can get to that point where they go, yeah, and is it personal, like you said, this individual had an adopted child, or just something that they just, you know, at their core say, you know, I'm gonna support this because it's the right thing to do, which I think is saying essentially you had an emotional reaction to it. And I think that's the best way to get somebody on board, because they're not just getting on board because you convinced them. Now they own it too. They own the issue too, right? So it's not yours. It's now ours. And once people are accepting it as this is our mission, it is more likely to happen. It's more likely to keep happening and be successful. And at the end of the day, it should not be about credit. It should be about what do you actually get done.
So since we're talking about relationships, I've actually been having this, I had an epiphany yesterday. And I haven't shared it out publicly yet. I'll probably do some little YouTube video on it. But I'd love to just maybe share the thought with you and just kind of get your reaction, if that's okay. Mm-hmm. So I teach, so my specialty, my focus is on influence. So right. Teaching people how to influence and networking and all that stuff kind of is in that bucket. And though I am a huge proponent of being very strategic with your networking, because we only have so much time, we only have so much energy. And we, if I know I'm doing something that's going to impact another agency, why would I not be very intentional building a relationship with someone at the agency so I can have that collaboration? Sure. But recently, the last maybe 3-4 weeks, I have had a number of people in my circle to move up into very senior level positions within their organizations. Even last night, I talked to a person on Instagram. Hey, how you been? Oh, I just got appointed to this position. Like, amazing opportunities. And it made me sit back and say, well, I mean, I had no idea this person was going to end up here, right? I'm blessed. I have the right people around me. So I guess my thought is, yes, to be strategic, but also just to be a good person, value others, but then also you have to have, I guess, a certain quality of people around you so that one day you can help each other. Hey, what are your initial reactions to that relationship building piece and having good people around you?
So I got a couple of reactions to that. I mean, the first, I guess, advice I'd give people that are in the early stages of this is make it genuine, right? It can't just be, you know, what can you do for me? It just, that tends not to be a good way to go about any relationship you have in life. I would say, look at the relationship just like you look at your relationship with friends too, right? It can't just be about you or, you know, what's the point of being friends from their side. And that's the way colleagues should be too, right? I'm not saying to be overly familiar and friendly with them, but I mean, if you have, you should go for a real relationship. I've seen many times where people tend to just focus up, right? They just focus on people who are their seniors. And then they find out when they get closer to the top, all the seniors retire and the only people left are your peers. So if you, and then it's like, you know, if you've been one of those guys, you know, those sharp elbow guys or whatever cliche you want to use, the only people left or your peers, and they're like, you know, you haven't been. So there's a do the right thing kind of point here. Have real relationships, but there's also a practical thing. Like, you don't want to be the guy that's known for, you know, only working up the ladder. You know, and if you want to get done on the way up, it's usually going to be your peers. So you have to have relationships, I think, up lateral or whatever we call it, you know, peers, and then your subordinates, right? You also have a obligation, unless you just totally be your enterprise for what you get out of it, not for what the purpose of the enterprise is. You have an obligation to bring up your subordinates, right? To be mentor, period. I don't think it's like, well, you're such a good guy or gal, you're being a mentor. I mean, I actually just think it's flat out part of your obligations. If you go above and beyond being a mentor, then you're a really good person. But just trying to bring up your subordinates to be able to replace you and be better at it than you is what I think your obligation is. And so, and hopefully, you know, if we're all doing this, then whatever enterprise, whether you're at the, you know, Environmental Protection Agency or the Navy or, you know, fill in the blank in the government or, you know, at a company, Apple, or it should be about something bigger than you and just your footprint in the enterprise. It should be about what you did to help advance their stated objectives. And if you don't like the stated objective, find a new place to go. Both upside and down eventually is going to be the most important legacy you have. What did you do to make the next generation better and ready to take the helm?
Feel free to disagree with me. But I think it sounded like you said mentoring other people and helping them become better than you. You meant to say, not doing that, right? Because if you become better than you, then you lose your job. So you don't want to do that, right?
Yeah. So, I mean, I good point. You know, you're like such a nice guy, you replace yourself. Yeah, I'm not really advocating that for anybody. But what I always viewed, because of the unit I was in, is we take pride in like almost knowing that the next generation of operators, and I came from a very unique unit called Special Activities Center in AG, would be more capable than us. You don't want to replace you, but like prematurely. I get that point. You gotta be so much pragmatic. You don't want to be like, okay, I guess, you know, what do you need me for? But you know, as you step out, I don't think it's a bad, I don't think it's a bad thing that you actually want to create the next generation that's better than yours, that just is better at doing everything than you, that's more accepting, that's more creative. You see what I mean? I do get the practical, because you're coaching these folks and you don't want to tell them, like, you want them to get the, and I get that. That's, everybody should be doing that. I mean, there's got to be competition's good. It's a good thing. It's a good thing in our culture. I'm just, I guess, the way I would adjust based on your obvious point is, yeah, you kind of like when you leave, when you got your watch and you're headed off to, well, Montana or wherever you're going to go, you want the next generation to be like better. Cause then you could say, I made my unit better while I was there. And I set it up for when I, you know, rode off into the sunset or into the mountain.
Yeah. I 100% agree with you. I'm just, you know, messing with you a bit. because at the end of the day, you're right. Like let me take it back. Again, the book I just read, Adam Grant, I've been referencing it a lot, but you know, he talks about the people who are so nice to a fault that they never get anything in their career, because they're going, yes, they're helping people, but they're helping people to the determinant or to their own hurting themselves. While, you know, like, if you know you have 5 hours to get a project done and someone says, hey, can you come over here and help me for 4 hours? And you're like, yeah. And you don't get your stuff done. That's not good either. Right. So I'm with you. We all should be focused on helping those who are coming up behind us and to the side and upward. At the same time, it's not negative to also care about yourself and your family. Sure. Want to move up.
Oh yeah. 100%. I mean, that at the end of the day, your primary responsibility should be to your family. Right. So, and if that means you're doing all the things necessary to move up, 100%. Like, just what I said about competition. I mean, it should be healthy and you should participate. You should want to do well. I think there's room for both, I guess is my point. And especially when you get to the end of your career, you know, at least for government services, it's very liberating to know when you're going to depart. At least it was for me. And I've talked to a lot of colleagues that have had the same kind of experience, that they're like, oh, I've actually told them I'm going to retire at the end of this assignment. And a lot of them start going, I'm going to focus on, like, they focus on what they're going to do next, of course, but they also focus on, I'm really going to mentor people. I'm really going to tell people, you know, I wish I was told a long time ago, and I'm going to do that. Whether it's on my time or not, I'm going to do it. So I would just say, yes, I totally agree. You should focus and make sure your stuff's done first, or that actually hurts the enterprise if you don't. And then, you know, leave some capacity to help others, I guess, would that be. And it's not just for them, even though it is important. It's also for the overall effort, because if it's, whether it's, you know, trying to make the environment a better place or trying to improve the security of the nation, one person, you need the group to be able to do it effectively. And that means you don't just need one or two people to do it really well and the rest of them to not. You need the whole group to row in the same direction.
And not to be too, to make this wonderful thing, this pure altruistic thing of mentoring, selfish, but I will admit that, you know, we learn through teaching other people stuff. Like if I learn something and I just keep it for myself, then I have it at a certain level, but if I can then explain it to someone else and it makes sense, it makes me understand it at a higher level. So there's a benefit. Absolutely. To mentoring other people.
No, I think that is very true. Teaching something is it's difficult. And many people have a hard time with it, but if they force themselves to do it, I think they become much better at whatever activity it is that they're teaching. And it, again, I think it, you know, if you're looking at it from the perspective of what we're trying to get done here, you need people who are good at it, teaching people who are not as good at it, either because they haven't been as much experience or they're just not as capable. So it benefits everybody. It benefits the overall organization. It benefits the teacher and the student.
We're starting to wrap up, but I do want to ask you, I mean, you know, we've been talking about mentoring and the relationships and so on and so forth. I'm interested in what advice was given to you that you felt was profound in your life, in your career. Can you share one bit of advice that was pivotal to you, and why was it pivotal?
I think when I was a lieutenant, you had this one in the Marine Corps. There was in typical Marine fashion, it was this career day, but you had to like run and do obstacle courses between each individual to tell you what you could do, right? So it was an extreme exercise intermixed with advice on careers. And we got to, and I was an infantry officer, but we got to the infantry officer. And he told us, you know, why you should want to be an infantry officer. But he started going through the whole career path because somebody asked him, you know, and this could apply for any group, not just the military. Like, if you want to get to this high job, you should do A, B, C, D, and D. And then he stopped halfway through and he goes, or, you know, you could find what you're passionate about, have a much happier career, feel much better about what you're doing, and let, you know, fate figure out where you end up. You know what I mean? Because he goes, chances are you might end up in the same place. And you have one guy or gal who followed a career path just because he or she was told that, whether she wanted to do it or not, and they're probably going to end up the same place. And even if they don't, I mean, you spend a large portion of your life in the career that you're doing. You should try to maximize your happiness in it, period. And, you know, this is coming from, there's not a lot of like touchy-feely stuff coming out of the Marine Corps. He wasn't trying to be touchy-feely, but, you know, really left an imprint because it was like, that's a good point. You know, if you want to take this job, but then, you know, you're really interested in doing that job, and you don't know. I mean, you should have a good coach like yourself help you get to where you want to go. But you also probably should put your goals. Like, if your goal is to really feel like you've had an impact doing something you like to do, vice, you know, being the next CEO of a company or a general or a DASD or whatever, you know, put it out there and then follow it. I mean, it's your life, so you got to live it the way, you know, it's best for you. That was something I remembered. Maybe it was because we had to go through all these obstacle courses to get there, but, you know, that's the way it is.
I absolutely love it. I love it. It reminds me of a book I'm actually in the middle of reading right now called Range. And it tells the story of like Tiger Woods and how everyone says, oh, Tiger Woods is, he was successful because he was practicing doing this one skill since he was like 3 years old or something like that. Right. But the research bears out is that most people who are super successful don't just start off doing the one thing. They've done multiple things. They lived their life. They tried new experiences and they just kept getting better and better. And so I think what you said right now is what was shared with you is powerful. And what you now just shared with everyone here is extremely powerful. Don't stress too much about finding that exact opposite, that exact position. As long as you're growing and experiencing new things and consistently being better tomorrow than you were today, you'll hopefully end up in the right place.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And that's exactly what I was trying to say. Hopefully folks they don't get to the end of their career and say, well, I should have done that, right? So hopefully we can reach people that are at the beginning and they can have a, you know, an internal discussion with it or talk to a coach or talk to a mentor, right? That's hopefully everybody can have that in their life.
Well, Mick, we're going to start wrapping up. I do want to open the floor back to you. Is there any ideas, thoughts, advice, anything you'd like to share with those who are with us today?
So, I mean, it would be very nice to bring up the issue that we really care about here at Lobo, which is the issue of child soldiers. I would like to double down on that. And it's not just, I mean, whether it's in child soldiering, there's lots of groups out there. One of the biggest actually went under because they just couldn't, it was one of those, it was like fatigue, they told me, where the donors were just, you know, there's so many things in the world with COVID and all this. It doesn't even have to be a contribution of money. I mean, you could volunteer, you can spread the news, you can, you know, use your social media for good. You know, you can start calling out people like, why are we allowing this to happen? And why aren't we doing more about it? So there's a lot of issues out there. And, you know, if you're interested in this, I would just push for your people to get more involved. And it doesn't have to be, it can be, but it doesn't have to be donations. It can be pushing your representative. It can be pushing international groups like the UN to do more about it. And it can, you know, I would just say if that's something that, and it is something that most adults can get behind, is the protection of kids. So I would just say, you know, that, and thanks for allowing me to bring that up.
Well, again, I want to underscore, please, everyone know, I mean, there's research to show that most people actually don't donate because they believe that their donation or donation of time, money, whatever, they think this not going to be, it's not enough to make a difference. And what Mick has just shared right now is that every little thing helps. So please, 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 if ending child soldiering is important to you, if you think that that is wrong, then please take some action today. Don't wait till tomorrow. Take action today. Mick, where can they learn more information about this?
So our institute is loboinstitute.org. And then if you go to the tab that says end child soldiering, there's a place to donate. There's also, if you just like to reach out to us, info@loboinstitute.org. And that's us. We support groups all over the world. The groups that are on the ground actually doing stuff. And then, of course, there's plenty of others. I mean, you can look at the child soldiers, NGOs that are out there, and you know, whether it's donating time or money. And then we're also part of the Grassroots Reconciliation Group, which is a longer established NGO that's focused specifically on the Lord's Resistance Army. So the story I told you about before, and they have, I mean, they're award-winning, UN award-winning group who has, I mean, last year helped rehabilitate over 500 kids. And you can see all about them. They're very integrated into the community. So like most of the organization comes from the community that are helping, right? So I would also advocate for them strongly, but just becoming involved in any way you could would be awesome.
Well, again, thank you. Thank you so much for all the time that, you know, the advice and all the stories and examples and experiences that you share with us today, Mick. I greatly appreciate it. I'm 100% sure everyone who's listening today and watching is greatly appreciative of everything you've shared. As always, I try to remind everyone, again, as what Mick was talking about, don't just look back. Reach back, right? Don't, if you know that you've heard something of value, of benefit today, don't just keep it for yourself. Find someone else to reach back and bring them with you. So share this content with them, share this interview with them, tell them that this is something that they need to have in their life. There's something they need to hear. So remember, please don't just look back, reach back. And our partner, Fed Upward, is a great place for any federal employee who's looking for information and guidance on, you know, just how to be a successful employee, all those technical skills as well. So it's a great podcast to join. And as always, I'd like to say thank you to Mick for joining us here today. Thank you for everyone here who's listening to us today. And as always, stay strong, stay positive, and definitely stay moving.
Thanks for listening. Find us online at thealextrembleshow.com and be sure to share what you've learned with at least one other person today. Check back on the first and third Wednesday of each month for new episodes. Until next time, stay strong, stay positive, and definitely stay moving.